Welcome to the inaugural episode of OMP Clinical Care Insider's Industry Partners Edition, an original podcast series produced by the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists. My name is Seth O'Brien, Chief Clinical Officer at Wheeler OMP and Chair of the Academy Scientific Societies Committee. Today, I get the pleasure of welcoming Jonathan Taylor, Director of Clinical Development and Education with Spinal Technology. Jonathan has 24 years of experience in orthotics and prosthetics, specializing in pediatric orthotics and scoliosis management. He's an international educator and has held senior leadership roles in manufacturing, R&D, and business development. Currently, he leads clinical development and education at Spinal Technology, driving global partnerships and scientific study. Welcome to the show, Jonathan.
Thank you, Seth. It's great to be here. An honor to be invited to the inaugural Industry Partners Edition. So hopefully we'll do a good job and you'll have us back someday.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm really excited about this. The idea behind this whole version of the show is that a lot of times we talk around specific brands or specific devices because we don't necessarily want to get into the weeds of one particular kind. And this really gives us an opportunity to dive into something that we're using clinically in practices all the time and really get a better understanding of when and why and where and who and all of those things. So I'm really glad to have you and looking forward to your insight for sure.
No, I appreciate that. I really think it's important to use industry for more clinical perspectives and feedback because we often look at industry as product-driven and devices and marketing and what are we going to use in clinic. But really, if you look at the industry partners and what they do is they are experts, significant experts in what they're doing in their products, but that area in that space of clinical care. So they have such a depth of knowledge that I think we really ought to lean on them for our clinical advice and care. And I stress that whenever I'm speaking to utilize, in our case, Spinal Technology for any spinal bracing, I think it's a big value. That's what we do, all we do. And the depth of knowledge here is really significant. So I encourage all clinicians to reach out and leverage those resources.
Speaking of which, so we have into the scoliosis management specialty for today. And looking at braces that are out there and devices that we hear of a lot, things like Providence and Boston and Milwaukee. So there's so many variations on these scoliosis braces. There has to be one that is just the best, right? There's got to be a simple one-stop answer that covers the whole spectrum.
Well, it's a big question. And I bet you if you ask around the world, you'll probably find a handful of experts that will say they know the answer to that. But reality, there is no answer to that. I think there's a lot of misunderstandings or misconceptions about various brace styles and types, and that there's, you know, some direct comparison of effectiveness and efficacy among brace designs. That's just really not the case. If you read through the literature, there is nothing in science and research that can demonstrate clear superiority of any one type of brace over another. So there's a lot more similarities among bracing types than there are differences. And I think we have to go back to really the basics of brace design and what we're trying to do mechanically in order to really understand what a brace is, what we're trying to do. We get confused around the world with names and types and styles and all these nuances and features that we think really add some significant clinical advantage when in reality, from the basic mechanics of what we're trying to do, there's nothing out there that really demonstrates anything above and beyond what we can do in other bracing types.
Right. Yeah. As clinicians, sometimes it's challenging to sift through. And I don't know if I end up almost approaching so many products or so many options that are out there almost cynically, right? It's like we have to sift through the marketing material to really try to get to the bottom of, okay, what is the clinical advantage or what is the indication or what's the contraindication? Sometimes I think it could be really helpful to have that just frank discussion about what are the advantages of one product or one style or one approach over the other, and what are we trying to accomplish and where maybe one is going to shine in this particular setting and a different option might be a better outcome overall in another setting or another compliance situation. What are some of the nuances between the different scoliosis braces that might really give an idea of what the indication for that particular design would be? Is it possible to run through just some of the basics about what differences we're looking at when we talk about something like just as an example, maybe a Providence or the Boston is probably, I would guess, the most widely known kind of name. And diving into some of the different ones, what are the differences that we're trying to accomplish with each of those?
Sure. I think if we look back first at what is a brace, and really a scoliosis brace, it's a plastic shell. And that shell is just a frame to hold mechanical forces. There's nothing more to it. The shape of that shell and how it's cut out and constructed, all it is just an anchoring point, and it's a structure for holding these corrective forces. Beyond that, and I think you hit on probably what's most important would be the compliance aspect of things. But even if you go back, I think what's most important really is for the clinician to understand how they're going to utilize that plastic framework to apply the corrective forces that we're trying to utilize to affect that patient and correct the deformity. So we have scoliosis with lateral deviation and axial rotation. And the only way to bring that back into balance are going to be specific force vectors that derotate and medially translate. And there are more efficient force vectors that can accomplish that. But you have the capability in just about any, most brace types anyway, to affect that. So if you go back years before bracing and you look at traction devices, where you'd have, say, a wooden framework with straps and pulleys and patient would sit down all day. Those straps and pulleys are applying a certain force vector that's derotating and medially translating, and they're correcting the deformity mechanically. But that's all we're doing within a brace. The variations among the braces really come down to some specifics in how we address our sagittal alignment and our balance. That's really where the differences end. So I think one of the biggest comparisons that you see these days is with the introduction more of the Cheneau style coming into the U.S. So as you mentioned, Boston is most well-known, and that's the most prominent brace in the U.S. and used quite a bit around the world and in Europe. But the Cheneau really, throughout most parts of Europe, has been the prominent brace in that market for just about as long as the Boston has been in the U.S. And there are some differences in how the two braces approach balance and alignment, and mostly in the sagittal profile, and looking at kyphosis and your derotation. Now, I think what gets missed here is that when you talk about the Cheneau, when you think about segmental derotation, which is often what's promoted or thought of in 3D type bracing, and taking a section of the torso and derotating that, segmental derotation, it sounds unique and it sounds advanced. And when you look at it and you put it into CAD, and we can talk about CAD in a minute, it looks much more advanced in that we're doing something more scientific to the patient, much more controlled. In reality, when you take a segment of the torso and you derotate it, you're effectively just applying force vectors, right? You're applying a posterior lateral force on the thoracic and an anterior contralateral force. So you're derotating that segment. Everywhere else, you're just providing relief. So you're not really holding the torso there. You're just applying those forces in a derotational and translational manner, but you can do that in a Boston style. So I think what's been lost over the years has been, I think, the teachings to the mechanics and effectiveness of what you're trying to accomplish within bracing types. So when I have conversations with, say, Schroth therapists that have a wealth of knowledge on the Cheneau, and they're very knowledgeable in scoliosis bracing, they don't have a perspective of how the Boston is approaching correction, and they have this, you know, a lot of misconceptions. So the big difference with the Cheneau and the Boston is how they manage balance over center sacral. So that's really where it comes into. And you'll have the Cheneau expert or Schroth therapist talk about pelvic shift, and the idea there is how we're going to bring our center sacral and our upper thoracic into balance over our center of gravity. And they're utilizing the lumbar and the trochanter to shift the torso, really. They say pelvic shift, but it's really shifting the torso over their center. And I think it's missed that we can manage that alignment with a Boston just as well. We're just using a different mechanism. So if you look at a Boston brace and you have a trochanteric extension and an axilla, we're utilizing the trochanter extension as a lever arm to manipulate the axillary extension. And that's how we're balancing over center sacral. So we have the ability to do that, and we have the mechanics. We're just using a different type of leverage and the different type of mechanics to accomplish it. So we're addressing all of the same components of the deformity, and we're able to manage all the same portions, whether we're doing that in a Boston style brace or a Boston 3D style or a Chinot or a Milwaukee brace. And the Milwaukee brace is just as three-dimensional as the Chinot. I mean, if we break it down and look at it simplistically, and I think we'll put some things in the show notes, I would refer to those that will help to try and illustrate those concepts.
You bet. And there's a great page on your website of spinal technology where it addresses all of the different scoliosis braces, and you can see the visual of a Providence versus a Boston versus something else, you know. And you really can see what each brace, you know, how it differs, what it maybe is trying to accomplish, and what those points of contact might be. And that'd be a great reference. We can put that in the show notes as well. And it gives a little insight as to some of the nuances between these different braces that ultimately, I think, are named after the cities in which they were developed, right?
Pretty much. It's mostly all based on geography, or maybe a person's name, but for the most part, it's all geography-based. I think when you break down, we're really trying to look for differentiation among effectiveness, or not so much effectiveness, but what's the real difference among bracing types or styles? I think you draw the line between nocturnal bracing and full-time bracing. That's really where you have a difference in approach, and you're utilizing and focus on some different biomechanical principles and developmental principles where it's a different approach and then you have similar outcomes. So in the research, nocturnal bracing has been demonstrated to be equally as effective, depending on the research you read, either equally as effective, more or less than full-time bracing. And again, I would go back to the research. There's nothing out there that can demonstrate real superiority over any other type of brace. However, what's really unique is that nocturnal bracing is demonstrating similar outcomes to full-time bracing. And so that has pushed some research in other directions and led us to think, all right, what are the advantages then? Are there advantages at night? I think there are some clear advantages. And what are the advantages during the day? And maybe what is the right solution? But a lot of it really comes back to, are we applying the mechanical correction, the forces that we need to correct the deformity? Are we maintaining it and sustaining that correction for a long enough period of time, depending on the time of day or night? And is the patient going to wear the brace? And beyond that, a lot of it comes down to the expertise of the clinician. If you've been using a Boston-style brace for 30 years, and you're very effective with it, you're getting good outcomes, your doctors are familiar with it, I would encourage you not to really veer too far away from that. And you're only taking chances and putting a lot more effort into trying to learn something new and unique that really is probably not adding significant advantage to your practice and the care of your patients. And I think just thinking about compliance and variations in compliance, a lot of that can come down to the confidence of the clinician and the confidence of the doctor in the treatment you're providing. And I think if you have confidence in a certain device and type and your patients are comfortable with it, then I wouldn't be encouraged to make many changes in that case. So
I do wonder where the trend may go, though. To that point, while we don't want to necessarily stray from the successful outcomes that we may be having, if there's really not a clear difference in terms of outcomes and research, and granted, the research sometimes have holes in it or have blind spots, but you think about the patient population that we're typically dealing with, maybe it's more so if you're on the fence of which direction to go. We're typically talking about adolescent patient population, and if you're considering a nocturnal brace versus something that's going to have to be worn all day, there's other factors that can go into that decision beyond just the simple anatomy and outcomes of that, right? If we've got the potential to make something much less intrusive into somebody's life, thinking about at school and just growing up as a teenager, there could be some real tipping points there if we're getting similar outcomes from a clinical standpoint, right?
For sure. Absolutely. And I think there's a couple of things you mentioned in there. And one is, it would add that a lot of bracing now, a lot of kind of questioning or drive to move into different types of bracing styles is patient and parent driven, because parents are doing their research online and they're finding a lot of information, good or bad, and that's driving them in certain directions. Some physicians are becoming more interested in new things, new to them, coming out of Europe, like the Chanel, or different types of 3D type braces, things that sound unique and advanced. And parents are finding those, and parents, that's their job to be advocates for the children. So that's a driving factor. Compliance really is and has been our biggest challenge in bracing for scoliosis forever. And you're right, patient population is primarily 11 to 13 year old girls, and they're going through some major changes in their lives, physically, socially, emotionally. They find out they have scoliosis and we're asking them to wear a brace. And that's a lot to ask. It's a lot to bring into their daily lives. I think that nocturnal bracing is a very good solution to alleviating a lot of the psychosocial impacts that may be having on these patients' lives. And it's interesting that the SRS has recommended to include within any research going forward some measure of patient satisfaction, quality of life, because there is an impact. We know that there's an impact on their well-being that might have some longer-term carryover that might affect them later in life. That I think is something we really have to consider. And it's not the same for every patient. And we know plenty of patients that do well that have been in a Boston for 18 hours a day for 3 to 5 years, and they're very successful, they're comfortable with it, but they may have a different support structure. They may have friends that are really supportive of them and their family. And maybe they're in a children's hospital where they have orthopedics and the orthotics and prosthetics, and they have nursing and they have physical therapy, and they have this really integrated care team that reinforces and supports them through this whole journey. And that might be different and be a different experience than if you're a little bit more remote and removed, and you're going to see an O&P practice that is not closely tied into things. Now, that might not be a negative, but it could be. You never know. That every environment is different. And compliance is the biggest challenge. And oftentimes, I think the nocturnal bracing is an excellent solution, particularly if you have patients that are struggling with compliance. I think the biggest question in my mind would be, if we have comparable outcomes of nocturnal bracing to full-time bracing, and why is that? We think it's because at night we have significant greater ability to correct, so we can hyper-correct, we can hold the patient in much more significantly corrected states, but we can overcorrect. And we have a lot of patients that will overcorrect 110% due to growth plate physiology. If we can level the forces across the growth plates, maybe we're gaining some ground. At night, that's when we're growing the most, right? The majority of our growth hormone is released when we're sleeping. And there has to be something to the advantages we're gaining within an 8 to 10 hour period of time at night and getting comparable outcomes to 18 to 20 hours full time. We know the goal of full-time bracing is, it's well accepted that 50% or greater in-brace correction is a successfully designed brace fit. At night, we're looking for at least 70%, maybe 80% in-brace correction. So my thought would be, what if we did both, right? If we're able to be so successful at night with this hyper-correction, I think the ideal scenario would be to have a Providence brace or a hyper-corrective brace at night and then something full-time during the day to stabilize. But I think that's a little bit of overkill. Someone has to pay for two braces. And I just think intuitively, it seems like that would make sense. But I just think it would be short-sighted of us not to consider nocturnal bracing for any of our patients if we have the option to do that and could be effective at it with it. So we do have some patients, actually, some customers of ours that do incorporate dual bracing, but those are somewhat unique circumstances.
It would be really interesting to see what that comparison might be from a quantitative perspective. You make a great point.
Let's take a quick break for a word from our episode sponsor, Spinal Technology. Spinal Technology is the global leader in the design and fabrication of spinal orthoses for the stabilization, immobilization, and correction of various abnormalities of the spine. For over 30 years, medical experts around the world have depended on their team of American board-certified orthotists, highly skilled technicians, and dedicated customer service experts for better outcomes and the highest quality of patient care. As specialists in orthotic solutions for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis, they understand that successful treatment requires seamless coordination among healthcare practitioners, families, and support teams. Beyond providing high-quality orthotic products, the team at Spinal Technology share their expertise and resources to empower practitioners and improve patient outcomes, creating a partnership with a stronger foundation for scoliosis management. Visit www.spinaltechnology.com to learn how they can support you.
The other thing that you mentioned in terms of patient choice and them doing so much more homework and the parents researching scoliosis and bracing and everything else, I wonder if you're seeing the same kind of trend that I'm noticing on the prosthetic front. Is it seems like patients and families are so much more acutely aware of, they're coming in with opinions on what they want or what they don't want. I've never seen so many patients coming in talking about K levels right out of the gate, right after surgery, or even in pre-op consults where they're talking about what K level are they going to be in. And I think all of that is great. I wonder, are you seeing the same kind of trend in access to information and being an active part of that care and the decision-making process on the scoli side as we are maybe on the prosthetic side?
Absolutely. Think about what's the first thing you're going to do when you go to the hospital and you see a surgeon or a specialist and you find out your child has scoliosis or anything else. Before you're even getting out of the hospital on your way out, they're on your phone Googling the condition and looking at what they mean, bracing. What does that mean? And the availability of information out there is incredible. And the amount of research that's been generated over the years, if you go to PubMed and do a search for adolescent idiopathic scoliosis brace, you take all the results and you graph that out, you're going to see a huge slope and increase over the last 15 years, where the amount of research and publications that have come out has dramatically grown. And that's great. Research is good. We like to see, we need to study things and we need to learn more. But it also had so much confusion, but it's all available. This is all publicly available and parents can find it. They can dig into it. I think that in O&P, there's more and more exposure online. We've got many more websites that are competently done. They look really good. And they all have conflicting information, but they really can give these parents a lot of ammunition. They can develop their own opinions and ideas, and they come in. And yeah, there's a lot of parent-driven choices that are being made. So we have to be aware of that. I think it's incumbent on the orthotist, too, to do their homework and be prepared for answering those questions and providing the information, correcting something that might be not accurate. And then you have to be on the same page with a physician. So that messaging is, we have to be that resource.
And sometimes it's important to remember too, I think it's great that patients and support systems and caregivers or family members have all of the access to this information, which can be great, but they also don't have the clinical knowledge or background, the education to help filter that information. So sometimes it has to be a very steered conversation or some extra time in that eval to make sure that we're arriving at the correct or the optimal decision, as opposed to just giving in and letting them steer the bus. As my old mentor, Mark Kirchner, used to say, you can't let them drive the bus, right? You got to help guide that.
That's right, for sure. And you have to guide it. You can't dismiss it either. So you have to acknowledge where they're coming from, what they've learned, and everything's in the best interest of their children. We have to guide it. Absolutely. But we have to do it knowledgeably. And if we don't know, we don't understand something that they're presenting, we'll say, you know what, I know a little bit about this, but I'll look into it some more. Let me get back to you. Or some way to make sure that the parents don't think you're dismissive of anything. But we do have to guide it. And we have to be on the same page with the physician so that we're sending the same message. Yeah, we don't blame any parent for wanting to try and drive things in a certain direction, but we have to instill the confidence that they're seeing a competent medical team that is going to guide them in the right direction too.
Yeah. Jonathan, you brought up the buzzword earlier about CAD/CAM, 3D printing, 3D design, digital workflow, that kind of stuff. Those are certainly major buzzwords within our field right now and all over the world at this point. But Where do some of those techniques and the digital design or the fabrication techniques fit into the equation, and where can they be really useful from Scoli's side of things, especially with what Spinal Technology is doing? How does that fit into the equation for you guys?
CAD has become a really great tool for us. CAD/CAM is really more of just a manufacturing and process tool, right? So it's not adding any specific value clinically, so to speak. It's giving us better tools, or more efficient tools, I would say, for us to interact with a patient. There's nothing in a 3D scan that I can do on a computer that I couldn't do with a mold from a cast and a bucket of plaster. It's just going to take me quite a bit longer, probably, and not going to have some of the information that I would have if I do it on the computer. So CAD adds a number of tools, streamlines, and makes things a lot more efficient. Obviously, we're not taking casts and we're not shipping things back and forth. It's much better process for the patients. We have a digital representation of that patient that doesn't go away. We always have it. And all the modifications that we apply are locked, right? So I can undo changes that I make. I can track them. The measurability of everything I do is significant in CAD. It's really great that I can measure volumetrically, know what I'm making, know what my changes are. But also some of the tools in CAD is that if I apply modifications, and if I look at it from scoliosis perspective, if I'm applying a lumbar pad and force onto a CAD mold and a file on the computer, if I find that I'm going to be doing that to many others down the road, I can save that modification as an overlay or as a tool that I can then just reapply to another scan down the road. And you can actually build in some automation. So if you have multiple modifications you're going to make, and this applies, CAD applies to FOs, prosthetics, and anything else that you're really doing systematically, you can tie those overlays and modifications together within a macro. Don't be confused with AI. It's not AI. It's just taking a series of modifications and reapplying them. So that's great. Being able to do that, measure it, follow it, undo it, the efficiency is fantastic. And if we're to, I mentioned segmental derotation, there is an advantage in being able to do that in CAD. Ultimately, it's applying to forces. However, when we take a segment and derotate it, we're also inherently creating the relief in voids. So we could take a section of the thoracic and just capture that and derotate that segment. So there's some advantages right in there. So a lot of it, though, is process in manufacturing type, but just design. It's CAD's automated design in manufacturing. There's nothing really magical about it beyond that, but definitely some advantages. And from a fabrication side, really efficient and effective for us. Now that the technology has come around from scanning in the last 15 years to where you can just, with an iPad and a structure sensor, you can get a very good scan of a patient for a couple thousand dollars in technology is fantastic. It wasn't that long ago. I'm sure you remember 25 years ago when it was $30,000 to $50,000 to get a scanner just to get into this technology. And boy, we've come a long way. So,
yeah, it's incredible what can be done now, and just the drop off in the barrier to pricing and access to those things. We're almost out of time, but I can certainly attest to, we had a situation with, I've got two younger clinicians here that are both CPOs, and it's no secret that I'm just a CP. I'm no help on the spinal side. And we came across this situation where we were a little bit intimidated to not want to make a mistake without that expertise of having a scoliosis specialist here. And are we capable of doing this correctly? And it's a little intimidating because we don't have a strong background in it. And, do we want to refer the patient out, or can we take care of them? And it was a physician that, we work closely with, and they wanted us to do it. And so we had one of your team in to help and, get them up to speed. And just the whole workflow from the scanning to getting the brace done and being able to provide that care and do it confidently was so much easier than we were worried about. The intimidation of not having a strong Scoli specialist on staff was completely gone. So a lot of those tools really helped to alleviate some of that as well. Certainly appreciate everything that you and your team do. And it was just a great experience for us That's something that happened well before this podcast was even dreamed up. I don't know that you're aware of that. I can thank you on the clinical side for that.
That's great to hear. It's actually something that we really have stressed and pride ourselves on. And that's a big resource that we bring to the field, the clinical support. And we will come out and help. We'll provide education. And I think that if it's an area like scoliosis or anything else, is for scoliosis to use us as that resource. We're happy to help. We're here for that. Our customer service, that's what we're very well known for, but our clinical support and training and education, we're in your back room, but we're there to support you throughout the process. Even fitting follow-up, embrace x-ray evaluations, that's what we love to do. That's our passion. We bring those resources to the table every day. That's what we love to do. And the more we can be involved in supporting you.
Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us and talking a little bit about scoliosis and for everything you're doing with Spinal Technology. We certainly appreciate you being here.
Well, I appreciate it. Thanks for having me. And we're always happy to be helpful and always happy to support. If anyone ever needs help, they just give a call. We're happy to talk and bring your knowledge to the table if we can.
We want to give a big thank you to all of you out there listening as well to this inaugural episode of OMP Clinical Care Insiders, the Industry Partners Edition. I hope you'll join us next quarter as we continue our conversation with key industry partners in the OMP community, discussing their areas of clinical care and sharing personal experiences as professionals in that specialty. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts. And don't forget to check out the Academy's award-winning podcasts for OMP professionals, OMP Research Insights with Dr. Steve Gard, and OMP Rising, a podcast created for emerging professionals in our field. For more information on the American Academy of Orthotists and Prosthetists, visit us online at onp.org. Thank you so much for listening, and we will catch you next time. At Spinal Technology, they take pride in sharing their knowledge through comprehensive training. Stop by booth 247 at the Academy annual meeting to learn how you can improve your patient compliance, or ask how the Spinal Technology's education program can support your clinical teams. They've got your back.